Well, it's time for us to wish our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today a very happy birthday. We have two listeners we're aware of on this April 10th. Linda Rearson from Jefferson and Steve Carnes from Des Moines. All of us here at IRIS would like to wish the both of you a very happy birthday. And we have an announcement here. IRIS has a limited number of free tickets to the Sunday, April 14th, 2 p.m. performance of Beautiful, the Carole King musical, with live audio description at the Des Moines Community Playhouse. Beautiful tells the story of the early life and career of Carole King, weaving a tapestry with songs that she wrote throughout. If you're interested, please call the IRIS office at 515-243-6833. And a reminder, you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on a list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now, here's Barb with today's obituaries.
Thank you, Dennis. Michael Keith Bryant of Des Moines was born August 1, 1952, passed away April 2, 2024. He graduated Signory High School in 1970 and Drake University with a BFA in Theater Arts in 1974 and MA in English in 1979. He taught English and supervised student publications at Drake and at DMAC. Further details may be viewed online at simplifyiowa.com. Paul J. Manner, 58, died Thursday, April 4th at Mercy One Medical Center. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 13th at Isles Grandview Park Funeral Home, where the family will receive friends 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Online condolences are welcome at islescares.com. Gilford Wayne Hawkins, Sr., 92, of Des Moines, passed away peacefully at home, surrounded by his family, on April 4th. He was born December 1, 1931, in New London, Missouri, to Jacob and Martha Hawkins. Gilford joined the United States Army and served in the Korean War. In 2019, he was able to take the honor flight with the help of his sponsor, Doug Taylor. Gilford Melton married Marilyn I. Love Hawkins in 1986 in New London, Missouri. A visitation will be held from 3 to 6 p.m. on Sunday, April 14th at Hamilton's Funeral Home at 605 Lyon Street. Funeral service will begin 11 a.m. Monday, April 15th at Maple Street Baptist Church at 1552 Maple Street in Des Moines. Burial will be held at 12:30 p.m. Tuesday, April 16th at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Adel. Jeanette E. Boldinghouse, 92, died Tuesday, April 2nd, at the Iowa Jewish Senior Life Center. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, April 12th, at Isles Westover Chapel, where the family will receive friends 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will follow at the Masonic Cemetery. Jeanette was born January 15, 1926, to Cecil and Nellie Wright in Leon, Iowa. The family moved to Des Moines in 1931, and Jeanette spent the rest of her life in Des Moines. After graduating high school, she worked full-time for the Des Moines Public School System as administrative assistant until her retirement. In 1978, Jeanette was united in marriage to Gail Boldinghouse. Jeanette was an active member of the Order of the Eastern Star and Daughters of the Nile. Survivors include her daughter, Joellen Adele of Des Moines, grandchildren Andrew Getman and Catherine Getman. Jeanette was preceded in death by her parents and her husband, Gail. Memorial contributions may be made to Acanthus Order of the Eastern Star. Online condolences are welcome at islescares.com. Shirley A. Carpenter of Ankeny was born June 6, 1931, to Harold and Mary Herndon in Des Moines. She passed away April 7th at home under hospice care at the age of 92. She is survived by her daughters, Connie Ostrom, Carol Carpenter, and Terry Carpenter, six grandchildren, 15 great-grandchildren, and a soon-to-be-born great-great-grandson. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, April 13th at Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens. with burial to follow at Highland Memory Garden Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Unity Point Hospice in loving memory of Shirley Carpenter. Condolences may be expressed online at hamiltonfuneralhome.com. Beverly Jean Plude Simpson died peacefully at Taylor House on April 7th after a short illness. Bev was born on March 2nd, 1928, the third of five children of Lewis and Myrtle Plude. She graduated from East Des Moines High School in January of 1946. It was at East where she met the love of her life, Richard E., known as Dick, Simpson. They were married on May 31st, 1946, and blessed with four daughters. They enjoyed 68 years of marriage before Dick's death in 2015. Bev was employed by UPS in the personnel department, where she met many lifelong friends. She was a member of Simpson United Methodist Church for 66 years, and also attended Union Park United Methodist Church with friends from Rose Glen. Bev was preceded in death by her husband Dick, parents, and siblings Tom, Lillian, and Dick. Those left to honor Bev's memory include her brother Lou Plude of Pleasantville, daughters Candace Blair of Des Moines, Judy Pertzborn of West Des Moines, Penny McKinley of Ankeny, and Barb Lane of West Des Moines, 9 grandchildren, 21 great-grandchildren, and many special nieces, nephews, and her dear friends at Rose Glen at Luther Park, where Bev lived the last 18 years. The family will greet friends on Friday, April 12th, from 4 to 6 p.m. at Hamilton's Funeral Home at 605 Lyon Street. A funeral service will be held on Saturday, April 13th, at 10:30 a.m. at Simpson United Methodist Church at 2600 Capitol Avenue in Des Moines. Interment of Bev and Dick's cremains will be held at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Van Meter, Iowa, at a later date. Memorial contributions may be directed to Taylor House Unity Point Hospice in loving memory of Bev. Condolences may be expressed at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Judy K. Forsman, 84, of Adel, passed away on April 5th at Spurgeon Manor from complications of dementia. A visitation will be held from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Thursday, April 11th at Caldwell Parish Funeral Home, Adel Chapel. A funeral service will take place at 10:30 a.m. Friday, April 12th at Adel United Methodist Church. A burial will follow the funeral service at Oakdale Cemetery in Adel. Judy was born May 9, 1939, to Howard and Helen Whitnibble in New Hampton, Iowa. Judy graduated from Fredericksburg High School in 1957. She then attended AIB in Des Moines, lived at the Des Moines YMCA, and played basketball for Look Magazine. Judy married Donald Forsman on May 31, 1959, and they were blessed with two children, a son Scott and daughter Joni. Judy was a stay-at-home mother until the children were in school full days. She worked at the Dallas County Extension Office, followed by secretarial duties at an Adel law firm. Judy was well known in the community, which led to her working at McCallie Funeral Home. She would say that this was the best job ever, being able to interact with people and provide support, as well as driving the hearse, which she thought was fun. Judy was preceded in death by her parents, an infant brother, and spouse. Judy is survived by her brother Jerry Whitnable of Medina, Ohio, son Scott Forsman of Ellsworth, Wisconsin, daughter Joni Williams of Nevada, Iowa, 6 grandchildren, 8 great-grandchildren, and several extended family members. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Adel United Methodist Church or Spurgeon Manor. Online condolences may be left at caldwellparish.com. Arrangements are being handled by Caldwell Parish Funeral Home, Adel Chapel. Patricia, known as Pat Ann Frelich of Winterset, 71, passed away peacefully on April 5th. Visitation will be held from 1 to 2 p.m. on Thursday, April 11th, at Memorial Services of Iowa at 4208 North Ankeny Boulevard, with a celebration of life beginning at 2 p.m. A private burial will follow at Ankeny Memorial Gardens. Pat is survived by her mother, Lou Nall, brother George Merrill, half-sister Christy Aruza, stepsisters Diana Adams and Carol Harrington, husband Keith, daughters Catherine Woollett and Karen Boaz, sons Michael Frelich and Jonathan Frelich, 7 grandchildren, as well as many nieces, nephews, and other loving family and friends. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the John Stoddard Cancer Center. Checks payable to the John Stoddard Cancer Center. Mail to Unity Point Health Des Moines Foundation, 1415 Moodland Avenue, Suite E200, Des Moines, Iowa, 50309. Gifts can also be made online at unitypoint.org/giving/John-Stoddard-Cancer-Center/donate. A complete obituary is available online at ankenymemorial.com. Carol A. Monahan, age 69, passed away peacefully on Sunday, April 7th, at Karen Acres in Urbandale. Carol was born on January 6, 1955, in Des Moines, to William B. Harbin and Betty J. Madison. She grew up in Des Moines. Carol worked at Wellmark for several years, retiring from there after fulfilling many different positions. Visitation will begin at 12 p.m., followed by funeral service at 1 p.m. on Thursday, April 11th, at Hamilton's Funeral Home, 605 Lyon Street in Des Moines, with a reception to follow. The full obituary may be viewed at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. James, known as Jim Raleigh Weston, age 73, passed away on April 7th. A visitation will be held on Thursday, April 11th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Ankeny Funeral Home. A funeral service will be held on Friday, April 12th, at 10:30 p.m. at Capitol Hill Lutheran Church. For a full obituary, please visit ankenyfuneralhome.com. A celebration of life for Marilyn V. Rapp will be held on Saturday, April 20th, from 1 to 3 p.m. at New Hope United Methodist Church in Des Moines. Memorials may be given to Des Moines Christian School in Urbandale, Iowa, or New Hope United Methodist Church Women's Circle in Des Moines. And Gary Wayne Jenkins, 66, of Adel, passed away on Sunday, April 7th, at Mercy One Medical Center in Des Moines. Gary was born in Des Moines on May 3, 1957, to Leo Jenkins and Mary Brower Jenkins. He was raised in Adel and was a lifelong resident of the area and attended school at ADM. Gary was an avid collector and admirer of Mopar muscle cars and loved going to drag racing events with his entire family. In his free time, Gary enjoyed anything to do with spending time outdoors in nature. He especially enjoyed hunting, as well as fishing and camping. When he wasn't outdoors, he liked to watch old Western movies on TV. Gary was also a huge animal lover and was known to never turn away a cat or a dog that needed a loving companion. He would be remembered as a loving and caring son, brother, and friend to many. Gary is preceded in death by his parents, his grandparents, Ted and Minnie Jenkins, and Guy and Ruth Brower, and his sister, Sandra Jenkins. Gary is survived by his brothers, Michael Jenkins and Sean Jenkins, as well as many cousins. A graveside service for Gary will be held at 1 p.m. on Friday, April 12th, at Oakdale Cemetery in Adel. Online condolences can be made to the family at caldwellparish.com.
Thank you, Barb, for those obituaries. Turning now to national news. Solar eclipse unites a divided nation. From Texas to Maine, millions flock to totality. For days, weeks, years, we waited. The orb of the moon was set to cross the face of the sun, the rare phenomenon that has captivated human observers since the dawn of time. A total solar eclipse. Over the course of several hours, millions of people would fall beneath the moon's shadow as it swept across the continent at some 1,500 miles per hour. At the center of that path, however briefly, the midday sun would vanish entirely, known as totality. The arc of the event was plotted by astronomers years in advance. It would begin over the blue depths of the tropical Pacific and end on the gray swells of the North Atlantic. Most of the route stretched from the flats of the Rio Grande Valley to the woods of northern Maine. The 2024 solar eclipse would be most singularly American. This country can often feel as if it is under a shadow. In Kansas City, Missouri, 89% eclipse, a collegiate athletics body grappled with the politics of who may play men's and women's sports. In the nation's capital, at 87% eclipse, lawmakers wrestled with the rules for online world where eclipse photos and divisive disinformation live side by side. In Eagle Pass, Texas, with 100%, recently hosted both the current and past president as a symbol of the painful reality and the fight of border migration. But in Monday's lunar shadow, American divides could not cleave one common, powerful experience as faces turned upward. This small city's airport took cosmic center space. It was near the middle of the path of totality. Eclipse fans came from far and wide. Brandon Beck, 43, arrived from San Diego aboard his friend's single-prop four-seater plane, built appropriately by the aircraft manufacturer Mooney. We're so lucky to be on a planet where the sun is the perfect size and the perfect distance to create that effect, he said. We have to see it. He spent the night in a sleeping bag next to the plane. Matt Lucas, age 59, rented a car and drove from San Diego to the Eagle Pass Airport. Eclipses, he said, remind us of our place in a larger world. In the scale of the universe, we're here for milliseconds, said Lucas, wearing a United Federation of Planets t-shirt, a nod to the Star Trek television series. That more than binds us together than divides us. At 10 minutes past noon local time, the small crowd at a small airport in a small town in South Texas waited anxiously. If only the clouds would part. Then, as if guided by some cosmic schedule, they did. A hushed darkness fell. In a hayfield north of the small town of Spencer, Indiana, dozens of people camped overnight near a tiny fishing lake ringed by hills. Some had driven from Wisconsin, Michigan, or Minnesota, looking to be near the center of the path and away from the big cities. Still more arrived after changing plans, swapping out destinations in cloudy Texas for largely clear blue skies in Indiana. They set up cameras and telescopes in the shade of lifted tailgates. They waited in folding chairs. Fishermen, retirees, and college students from nearby Bloomington made fast friends, sharing special binoculars and passing out popsicles. As the sun became a crescent, the temperature dropped more than 10 degrees and a fluttering American flag fell limp. 30 seconds, someone yelled. Among the red buds and the silver maples, the light turned the color of ash. Circling turkey vultures took to the trees. Crickets and frogs began to chirp. People whooped and gasped and yelled as they took off their eclipse glasses to see a black sun ringed with gold. Along the hills around the lake, the sky turned the orange-yellow of sunset in every direction at the same time. "Oh, my God. Oh, my God. This is so cool," said Tim Watson, age 60, a retired IT worker who drove from Madison, Wisconsin, with his brother Chris, age 64, for their first total eclipse. When the sun came back, out nearly 4 minutes later, another gas went up. As the two orbs, one light, one shadow, passed each other in time and space, the shapes and colors shifted along the path below. Outside Little Rock, Arkansas, in Cincinnati, couples gathered Monday to marry in mass ceremonies as the eclipse turned wedding days into wedding nights. Students spilled out of Ida B. Wells Middle School in Washington, D.C., gripping cardboard solar eclipse glasses and chattering with excitement. "Why is the sun shaped as a moon?" one student asked. "Why is it not getting dark?" asked another. Teacher Troy Mangum, a.k.a. Mr. Mango, explained the science as he cautioned others to put on their glasses. In Carbondale, Illinois, below NASA's balloon soaring up to study the sun's corona, a university dance troupe performed To the Fifth Dimension's Aquarius, Let the Sun Shine In. Amber and Cody Stallings drove from Atlanta to the banks of the Ohio River in Evansville, Indiana, with their infant daughter, Sadie. "The total eclipse brought tears to my eyes," Amber said. Sadie was strapped in a stroller as her parents shielded her eyes from the spectacle. "She won't remember it," they said, "but at least she got to say she was here." For a moment, far outside any human control, two celestial lines had intersected. All the experiences beneath them had been part of a shared path. Then the two orbs in the sky parted ways, each again tracing its own separate arc through space. The darkness ended, leaving each person below to contemplate what remained in the light.
Trump's bids to delay his April 15th trial are rejected. Former President Donald Trump lost a bid Tuesday to delay his April 15th criminal hush money trial, while a New York appeals court considers an emergency appeal to overturn a gag order imposed against him. New York appeals judge Cynthia Kern refused a trial delay after hearing arguments from Trump's legal team and Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office on Tuesday, Reuters reported. A full panel of appellate judges will consider Trump's challenge to the gag order at a later point. In the gag order, trial judge Juan Merchan barred Trump from making public statements about family members of Merchan or Bragg that are meant to significantly interfere with work in the case. The protections under the gag order were added after Trump attacked the judge's daughter in several social media posts, including posting a photo of her. The judge also prohibited Trump from making such statements when it comes to court staff and prosecutors other than Bragg himself, as well as those individual family members. In addition, Trump can't comment on potential and actual jurors or on the participation of witnesses in the case. Quote, it merely injects fear in those assigned or called to participate in the proceedings, that not only they, but their family members as well, are fair game for defendant's vitriol, Merchan wrote. On Monday, New York Appeals Judge Lizbeth Gonzalez also rejected a separate emergency bid from Trump to delay the trial until after a decision is made on his request to move the case out of Manhattan. Trump faces 34 appellate counts of falsifying business records to cover up a $130,000 hush money payment to adult film actress Stormy Daniels, who says she had sex with Trump while he was married. Trump denies Daniels' claim and has pleaded not guilty to all the charges. In his Monday request, Trump argued a fair and impartial jury cannot be selected right now based on prejudicial pretrial publicity. He said the trial should be put on hold until after a New York appeals court rules on his request for the case to be moved to another jurisdiction. In an earlier motion seeking to delay the trial, Trump's legal team said 93% of Manhattan residents in a private survey indicated they had seen media about or at least one of the criminal investigations he is facing. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office responded that Trump's incessant rhetoric is generating significant publicity, and it would be perverse to reward defendant with an adjournment based on media attention he is actively seeking. Meanwhile, in a legal brief to the Supreme Court, Special Counsel Jack Smith laid out his argument in a landmark case being heard later this month. No precedent before Donald Trump has suggested the Constitution grants him criminal immunity, and the Supreme Court shouldn't now find that it does, Smith said Monday. The absence of any such absolute immunity claim throughout our history weighs heavily against its novel recognition now, Smith wrote in his brief. The legal filing comes ahead of the Supreme Court's April 25th oral arguments in Trump's appeal of a decision that he's not immune from prosecution. Trump wants the Supreme Court to dismiss his indictment on federal charges he tried to steal the 2020 election, arguing criminal prosecution presents a mortal threat to the independence of the presidency. Quote, nothing in constitutional text, history, precedents, or policy considerations, Smith said, supports the absolute immunity that the petitioner seeks. While former presidents have broad immunity from civil lawsuits for official actions taken while serving in the White House, Trump has attempted to claim sweeping immunity from criminal prosecution. Smith argued that any immunity former presidents enjoy for official acts would not apply to Trump, because attempting to overturn an election and thwart the peaceful transfer of power is the paradigmatic example of conduct that should not be immunized, even if other conduct should be. Smith said granting Trump criminal immunity would be a radical legal precedent. A bedrock principle of our constitutional order is that no person is above the law, including the president, he told the court. Trump's lawyers will get a chance to respond to Smith's argument in their final legal filing before facing the 9 Supreme Court justices, 3 of whom were appointed by Trump when he was president. In Georgia, Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis is fighting former President Donald Trump's appeal to remove her from his election interference case based on her romantic relationship with another prosecutor. Fulton County Superior Judge Scott McAfee ruled in March that Willis could remain on the case if Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade stepped down, which Wade immediately did. Trump has asked the Georgia Court of Appeals to overturn McAfee's ruling. Trump and 14 co-defendants are charged with a racketeering conspiracy to try to steal the 2020 election from President Joe Biden, who won Georgia. Four other defendants have pleaded guilty. Trump and eight co-defendants, Rudy Giuliani, Mark Meadows, Jeffrey Clark, Robert Shealy, Michael Roman, David Schaefer, Harrison Floyd, and Catherine Latham, contend the Court of Appeals should disqualify Willis from the case. They argued she had a financial stake in the case and had wrongly talked about the case outside of court. The appeals court has 45 days to decide whether to hear the case. McAfee will continue moving the case toward trial, which hasn't been scheduled.
Norfolk Southern to pay $600 million to settle Ohio suit. Norfolk Southern has reached a $600 million class action lawsuit settlement over the February 3, 2023 train derailment in East Palestine, according to those involved in the case. The lead attorneys representing the victims and Norfolk Southern announced Tuesday that the two sides had reached an agreement in principle. Both sides issued statements about the deal, which also would need approval from U.S. District Court Judge Benita Pearson. A Norfolk Southern freight train, train 32N, carrying hazardous materials to Conway, Pennsylvania, derailed last year and caught fire. It happened in East Palestine, a village of nearly 4,700 people near the Ohio-Pennsylvania border. Five of the train cars had a toxic flammable gas called vinyl chloride, used in plastic products, and can cause certain cancers. To prevent an explosion, people were evacuated and a controlled release of gas was conducted on February 6, 2023. The first lawsuit was filed the next day. By April of 2023, at least 31 lawsuits had been filed, and Pearson consolidated them into a single class action lawsuit. If approved by the federal judge, the settlement would resolve all plaintiff cases consolidated into the class action lawsuit. It does not resolve separate lawsuits filed by state and federal agencies against Norfolk Southern for the environmental cleanup. Those are still pending. The victim's attorney said the agreement would also include a voluntary program to compensate individuals in a 10-mile radius for past, present, and future personal injuries resulting from chemical exposure. They added certain agreement details need to be finalized. Attorneys also said the settlement money would be in addition to any monies that Norfolk Southern has previously made available through community assistance and other payments. And that does it for this first part. It's been our pleasure to read for you. I'm Dennis May, and my partner at the microphone has been Barb DeHack. And now we're going to take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Patty Daniels, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. We'll continue with articles now from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And here is Patty with our next article.
From the opinion page, Trump is right. No to national abortion ban. Written for us by Ingrid Jacques. After making voters guess for months what his abortion stance would be, former President Donald Trump announced on social media Monday that he doesn't support a national ban on abortion. Trump's right on this one. At the end of the day, this is all about will of the people, Trump said in a video statement on Truth Social. The hard part for him now, however, will be to stay consistent. Abortion became a states' rights issue after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, and states across the country have taken vastly different stances on reproductive rights. That is exactly what was supposed to happen once the federal constitutional right to abortion disappeared. So it makes sense that Trump would want to leave the abortion debates to the states. By taking the immediate threat of a national ban off the table, Trump also may help bring down the temperature of the abortion rights discussion and make it less of a pressing issue heading into the presidential election. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris have pinned a lot of their re-election strategy to fear-mongering on abortion. They hope to harness the pro-abortion rights momentum that the country saw after Roe was overturned. They also want to distract voters from the fact that Biden is too old and unpopular, and that many voters have moved on to other issues. From immigration to the economy to the ongoing Israel-Hamas war. Elections in 2022 and 2023 overwhelmingly saw voters, even in red states, come out in favor of expanded abortion access. States such as Michigan and Ohio have passed constitutional amendments ensuring broad access to abortion. This year will be the true test to abortion's staying power as a motivation for liberal-leaning voters. Voters in increasingly red Florida, for instance, will decide on an abortion rights amendment on the November ballot, just as the state Supreme Court recently allowed a new 6-week abortion ban to take effect. Democrats hope that having that issue on the ballot will turn things in their favor by encouraging a strong turnout of their supporters and give Biden better odds in a key state that Trump won twice. We'll see. Trump's messaging on abortion is about as mercurial as one would expect coming from the former reality TV star. His abortion stance seems to be tied to where the political winds are blowing rather than to any personal conviction. Trump's gone from being very pro-choice in the late 1990s to declaring himself the most pro-life president in American history after Roe was overturned. After all, Trump appointed the 3 Supreme Court justices who made that ruling possible. Since then, however, Trump has criticized Republicans for not getting their messaging right after the Roe decision and has warned that cracking down too hard on abortion rights would backfire. For instance, Trump said Florida Governor Ron DeSantis made a terrible mistake when he signed the 6-week ban last year. Trump also has consistently supported exceptions to the abortion bans in cases of rape, incest, and threat to the mother's health. That has confounded some of Trump's pro-life supporters. Yet, if the choice is between pro-abortion rights Biden and Trump, the anti-abortion crowd will surely side with Trump. Politically speaking, Trump is smart to take a national abortion ban off the table and keep hammering on the issues that are driving Americans' concerns in 2024. And if you wanted to talk to Ingrid, she's a columnist at USA Today, and you can find her at iShock at usatoday.com.
The second opinion piece in today's USA Today, public's fear is a greater threat than bird flu outbreak itself. This is written by Dr. Mark Siegel. He's a member of the Board of Contributors of USA Today and the professor of medicine at New York University's Langone Health. I have tracked deadly massive outbreaks of H5N1 avian influenza in poultry for the past two decades. Hundreds of millions of birds have died, and there has been frequent spillover to other species, including mink, seals, foxes, skunks, and even dogs and cats. This week, the nation's largest supplier of eggs stopped production after birds at a plant in Texas tested positive. About 2 million chickens were slaughtered to prevent spread of the illness. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also reported that a person in Texas had contracted the flu, but is displaying only mild symptoms. The public has worried at times about a massive human pandemic, but since 2005, the structure of the bird flu virus has not changed significantly. That is extremely good news, especially when you consider that gain-of-function research conducted in Dr. Ron Fauchier's lab in the Netherlands in 2011 revealed the mutations needed for bird flu to pass from human to human. Monitoring of the virus in nature has shown that those mutations have yet to occur. I spoke with CDC Director Mandy Cohen, who told me that the current spillover of bird flu to cattle has not shown any significant genetic changes. That is also good news. The outbreak has occurred only in a few states, Idaho, Kansas, Michigan, New Mexico, and Texas, but cattle are brought from state to state and could have picked up the virus from birds. Dr. Cohen told me that the cattle have shown mild upper respiratory symptoms. The patient in Texas also had mild symptoms, conjunctivitis, and upper respiratory symptoms. She said the man was treated with Tamiflu and quickly got better. People in close contact with him also were given Tamiflu as a precaution against further spread. Dr. Cohen said there is potential for cattle to become the first mammals to become a reservoir of the bird flu. The CDC is working closely with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to track cattle that have or have been exposed to the illness to determine if there is any sustained spread. Over the past two decades, more than 400 million birds either have died from the disease or been culled to prevent transmission. Yet human cases remain rare, with only 2,634 cases and about 1,000 deaths. Don't get me wrong. It is the potential for the virus to adapt to human transmission over time that keeps many scientists and public health specialists up at night. But far too often, those experts are looking at worst-case scenarios to the detriment of public perception. Fear is at the heart of public and media reactions to the potential of bird flu and other viruses to become a much deadlier threat to humans. David Nabarro, a senior World Health Organization expert on infectious diseases, warned the public in 2005 that up to 150 million people could die of bird flu. And though his prediction was far from reality, it was taken seriously. Since then, there have been intermittent flare-ups of public fears, stoked by the idea that bird flu will become the WHO's so-called Disease X, a virus with a high death rate that spreads quickly. But the species barrier that protects us from bird flu is still in place, and the risk to the public remains extremely low, according to the CDC director. That is not only reassuring now, but also is likely to continue to be the case. The greater danger remains the fear of the virus rather than the virus itself. But there is one major caveat. The roadmap developed by Dr. Fauchet for a mutation deadly to humans could end up in the wrong hands. And that risk is enough to keep everyone up at night.
It's time for the sports today. Excuse me. We'll start with sports on TV. All of these times now are Eastern time. Hockey, National Hockey League, 8:30 p.m. TNT, Vegas at Edmonton. Basketball, the National Basketball Association, 7:30 p.m. on ESPN, Dallas at Miami. 10 p.m. ESPN, Minnesota at Denver. Baseball. Major League Baseball, 1:10 p.m. MLB and LA Dodgers at Minnesota. 1:15 p.m. MLBN, Philadelphia at St. Louis. And then at 3:10 p.m. we have ESPN, Arizona at Colorado. 3:45 p.m. MLBN, Washington at San Francisco. 4:07 p.m. MLBN, Tampa Bay at LA Angels. 7:05 p.m. AMZP, MLBN, Miami at New York Yankees. 7:10 p.m. MLBN, Baltimore at Boston. And then at 8:05 p.m. is MLBN, Oakland at Texas.
Looking at the front page of the sports section, Drake coach McCollum ready to make jump to Division One. It's accompanied by a photograph of Ben McCollum at the Knapp Center, where he was introduced with athletics director Brian Harden of Drake and the university president Marty Martin. This is by Tommy Birch. Despite getting passed over for the Drake basketball coaching job in 2018, Ben McCollum kept in touch with Bulldogs Director of Athletics, Brian Harden. McCollum and Harden, who first met during that coaching search, talk several times a year. McCollum, a successful coach at Division II Northwest Missouri State, reached out to Harden for feedback about potential jobs as he contemplated making the jump to Division I. Harden said he would sometimes call about what I would think about certain positions that were open. I knew athletic directors or kind of what the situation was and if I knew anything about how they were supported from their fans to their university. The job that McCollum really wanted was Drake. The problem was that it wasn't open, but McCollum got another shot at it last month when Darren DeVries left for West Virginia. Harden had paid close attention to what McCollum was doing over the years and thought he was the perfect candidate this time around. He clearly won the opportunity this time, Harden said. McCollum, who spent the last 15 seasons at Northwest Missouri State, was formally introduced as the new Bulldogs coach on Tuesday during a press conference full of fans, family members, and boosters. It was a moment McCollum had been waiting years to experience. Ben has had numerous other opportunities to become a Division I head coach over the past few years, Harden said, but he waited for this position to open. He didn't want to just be any Division I head coach. He wanted to be the Drake head coach, and that matters. That matters, and it's why he's a tremendous fit for our campus and our community. McCollum has put together a compelling case for making the jump to Division I, compiling a 394-91 record while guiding Northwest Missouri State to four national championships in 2017, 2019, 2021, and 2022. He was named NABC Division II National Coach of the Year five times. I always felt like the jump to Division I is something from a challenging perspective I wanted to make, McCollum said. Drake seemed like the right fit for years. McCollum, who was born in Iowa City and grew up in Storm Lake, wanted to come back to his home state. He figured Drake gave him the chance to accomplish his goals of having an impact on his players and the community around the school. So McCollum applied for the job and interviewed for it back in 2018. He was such a strong candidate that Hardin took him to meet with Drake president Marty Martin. Martin said, "We spent almost 2 hours together getting to know each other, talking about his vision for how he uses the platform that that's extended to him to enrich the lives of young men that he coaches. It was a wonderful conversation. I was incredibly impressed with him." But DeVries, an Iowa native himself and a longtime assistant coach at Creighton, got the job and guided the Bulldogs to 6 straight 20-plus win seasons and 3 appearances in the NCAA tournament. Meanwhile, McCollum turned his team into a perennial powerhouse at the Division II level. Both of their stocks soared as DeVries' name got tossed around in numerous head coaching vacancies. McCollum waited to see what he'd do. I think last year, too, we thought that he might leave. He might end up going. And so we started to kind of try to look for it at that point and see if it would fit us, McCollum said. McCollum had such a big impact on Martin and Hardin during his first interview that he quickly became a candidate again this time. Hardin wanted somebody who had sustained success and would be able to sell the program to the campus and the Des Moines community. Hardin had targeted some sitting Division I head coaches and high-level assistant coaches, but thought McCollum could do that better than any of them. Hardin's faith that McCollum was the right choice was reaffirmed when the Drake AD reached out to other members of the basketball community to get feedback on the coach. Over the years, McCollum had generated a reputation as an offensive wizard. High-level coaches reached out to him for advice. Some even sent him film to evaluate. The ones Hardin reached out to had high praise for McCollum. Hardin said, "The more that these high-profile coaches got to know Ben, the more they appreciated how Ben not only develops young men on the basketball court, but these elite coaches took notes on the bonds he formed with his guys that taught life lessons to these men." The challenge now is creating new bonds quickly. McCollum inherits a roster that was hit hard by the transfer portal after DeVries left. McCollum said he's been on the phone almost nonstop trying to retain some of those players and add some new ones. He's also made some recruiting visits. McCollum said he's not worried about any challenges that may come with making the jump to Division I basketball. He believes the secret to his success has been the time he's put into his players and building strong relationships with them. He said having a larger staff should allow him to focus even more on that. Still, there are changes he'll have to make. McCollum said, "I think the adjustment is just getting players to do what you want them to do earlier when you don't have continuity. So how quickly can you implement a system, implement a culture, get them to play at the level you want them to play at offensively and defensively? That's going to be the biggest transition." But McCollum believes he is up for the challenge. He said, "It's exciting. Obviously, you've got to get a lot of players really quickly, so that's tough. But we're going to fight for those, and we're going to get the right kids and build the culture the way it's supposed to be built."
I think we have time for one more sports article, and there's a photograph here. Scottie Scheffler hits out of a bunker during a practice round for the Masters at Augusta National Golf Club. There is a photograph of a man swinging a golf club, and looks like he's doing a really good job of it. Scheffler opens Masters week as prohibitive favorite. Excuse me. Scottie Scheffler opened Masters week favored by odds makers to a degree not seen since Tiger Woods' prime. The 22 champion has won 2 of his past 3 starts and came a short putt away from forcing a playoff in the third. Scheffler, 27, has a firm grip on the number one spot in the official world golf ranking and as the favorite ahead of this year's Masters. He is the consensus plus 400 favorite at regulated sports books on Monday, including BetMGM, BetRivers, and DraftKings. His closest competition at all three is Rory McIlroy, who is 1,100 plus at BetRivers and 1,000 plus at the other two. McIlroy is number two in the world, but the four-time major champion is still seeking his first triumph at Augusta National and to snap a major drought that has reached a decade. Meanwhile, Scheffler has continued to put distance between the two at the top of the golf world. He leads the field with 8.1% of the total winning bets and 18.7% of the total money since opening at plus 900 at BetMGM. That makes him the book's third biggest liability. Topping that list is Brooks Koepka, who has spread his five major championships across the U.S. Open and the PGA Championship. Koepka, 33, finished second at Augusta last year after holding the 54-hole lead and also was the runner-up in 2019. At plus 2,000, Koepka has the fifth shortest odds at BetMGM, where he is second to Scheffler with an 8.0% of the bets and 11.8% of the money. The book's second biggest liability is the emotional favorite, Tiger Woods, whose storyline this week will be first about being able to tee it up on Thursday, and then whether he can break the record with 24th consecutive made cut at the Masters. Woods is a plus 15,000 long shot to win a sixth green jacket this week. Koepka is one of 13 LIV golf players in this week's field, which also includes defending champion John Rahm. This is Rahm's first major since signing with LIV in December, and he has the third shortest odds at all three books. The Spaniard is plus 1,200 at BetMGM and plus 1,100 at DraftKings, where he opened the week having been backed by just 4% of both the total bets and money waged on the winner. If Koepka, who leads the total money at DraftKings with 13%, while Scheffler has garnered 11% of both markets, another former Masters champion, Hideki Matsuyama, is third with 6% of the money backing him to claim a second green jacket this week.
And it is time to turn to Dear Abby. There are three letters. One is longer, so I'll read the first one, Patty, if you'll take the rest of the article. Quarter-century marriage is an intimacy-free zone, is the headline. Dear Abby, I'm in a sexless 25-year marriage. It was not always this way, but any intimacy has been over for more than a decade. My wife's libido has waned, which I understand. What she does do is continually bring up issues about me from years ago, as if they were yesterday. I have my faults, like lack of communication and shutting down, which I have objectively thought about a great deal and tried to make things right. I'm not violent. I don't use drugs or abuse alcohol. She remains adamant in her distrust of me and punishes me by withholding all forms of intimacy. We attended marriage counseling, where I listened to her and acknowledged my issues for redress. She, on the other hand, justifies her actions and behaviors. She has her own failings, but doesn't want to hear how much her actions have hurt me. She also didn't listen to the counselor and will not hold herself accountable. I feel so lonely. She thinks a lack of intimacy is fine for a marriage, and this is frustrating to me. I have brought this up to her numerous times, but she will not be moved. I could use your counsel on this. Signed, Lonely Man in Georgia. Abby writes, Dear Lonely Man, you tried counseling. Counseling failed. lack of intimacy of any kind is not fine for a marriage. Call an attorney and set yourself free.
Dear Abby, during my 30s, I am now mid-70s, I did some nude modeling for several reputable photographers, which resulted in some lovely portraits. A few of them have been framed and hang on my bedroom wall. My family members are aware of them, but they are very religious, which I am not, so I don't know how to dispose of them. Should I try to sell them, and if so, how? Should I bequeath them to someone, or should they be left for my estate executor to deal with? What to do? Signed, Portraits in the South. Dear Portraits, definitely discuss this with your executor well before the need arises. If the photographers are well known, go online and find out if there's a market for their work. Offer the portraits for sale and see if there is any interest. You could also bequeath them to an open-minded relative or friend. I wish you luck. Dear Abby, in a response to Ganged Up on December 23rd, you stated that it is against the law to hit a child in California. It was in response to a woman whose mother-in-law spanked her grandchild. I was born in California and lived there more than 50 years, and I believe you misinterpreted the penal code. It is not illegal to spank in California. It is illegal to use excessive force or to cause traumatic injury when doing it. I don't personally believe that a child should be hit, but it is not illegal. In fact, corporal punishment, not abuse, is legal in every state in the U.S. Signed, Denise E. in Nevada. Dear Denise, mea culpa. I stand corrected. You are not the only reader I heard from after printing that answer. Thank you for straightening me out about this. And you can contact Abby at www.dearabby.com.
That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Patty Daniels. Earlier, you heard Barb DeHeck and Dennis May. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.